Ner Hashem Nishmat Adam, we are told in Proverbs. The soul of man is the candle or lamp of God. The soul of man, not the angel, is the lamp of God. Which means, I think, that in discovering our humanity, we discover the light within us all. Welcome to A Journey Through the Siddur, Episode 2. My Grandfather versus Socrates. The Body, the Soul, and the Morning Blessings. I'm Meir Soloveitchik.
Rabbi Soloveitchik's Journey Through the Siddur series is sponsored by Sherry and Neil Cohen in memory of their parents, Beatrice and Paul Milberg, and Harriet and Norman H. Cohen.
One of the most exquisite paintings in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and also one of the least Jewish, is Jacques-Louis David's The Death of Socrates. In the painting, the intellectual father of philosophy sits in his cell in an Athenian dungeon, holding in his hand the hemlock that will take his life. His disciples surround him, with the one closest to him clutching his teacher's foot. This is Crito, who had suggested that Socrates escape. Crito seems to be lovingly grasping Socrates, as if attempting to keep his teacher here on earth. But Crito's gesture of affection seems unreciprocated. Socrates' other hand, the one not holding the hemlock, reaches not to Crito or to any of his other students, but toward the heavens above, to the spiritual realm that Socrates believes imminently awaits him. And because he believes his soul will slip the surly bonds of earth, he, Socrates, is eager to embrace the severing of spirit and body that is about to occur. For Socrates, his body is only a shell and is not part and parcel of his eternal self. The soul will perceive truth, he believes, more fully when it flees this world. And that is why, as he puts it, the soul runs away from his body and desires to be alone and by herself. Socrates further explains that now that he is being forced by the Athenian state to leave this world behind, the severing of body and soul is something that he welcomes. I reckon, he says, that we make the nearest approach to knowledge when we have the least possible intercourse or communion with the body and are not surfeited with the bodily nature, but keep ourselves pure until the hour when God himself is pleased to release us. And thus, having got rid of the foolishness of the body, we shall be pure and hold converse with the pure, and know of ourselves the clear light everywhere, which is no other than the light of truth. So he says, this is his perspective. Our souls and only our souls are our truest selves, and it is only upon departing this world that our soul truly achieves liberation. Judaism, of course, also believes in an immortal soul and in heaven, but it is still no exaggeration to say that Jewish liturgy embodies a total rejection of the perspective of Socrates. The first words of the Siddur comprise one small sentence, an expression of gratitude. This is taught to children to be recited at the moment that they wake up. Mo'odeh ani lefanecha melechai v'kayem, shechazarta bi nishmati, b'chemla rabba emunatecha. I give thanks before you, eternally living King, that you have restored my soul in me, in mercy, in an abundance of faithfulness. Shechazarta bi nishmati, you have restored my soul in me. The me, of course, is one's physical self, and it is the union of soul and body that is the ultimate source of gratitude. Thus, the Siddur follows up this small message with a longer bit of liturgy. Elokai neshama shenatata bi tohorahi. My Lord, the soul you have placed in me is pure. You created it, fashioned it, and breathed it within me. You will in the future take it from me and return it to me in the end of days. Again, who is the me in which the soul is placed? It is the body. As I've noted in Bible 365, traditional Judaism rejects the notion that only the soul embodies our essence. Both body and soul makes us who we are. When as children we seek solace in our mother's arms, it is not only an appendage that we are embracing, it is our mother's. When our little children lie asleep, it is not their souls we caress in their cribs. And when we are in love, it is not only our spouse's soul to which we are attracted. Death is mourned in Rabbinic Judaism because it is a cleaving of body and soul. And though we, of course, believe in an afterlife, Judaism's ultimate eschatological yearning is the resurrection of the dead, which involves the restoration of soul to body. It is true that heaven is a realm without pain and suffering. And it is true, as Socrates suggested, that heaven is a realm in which truth can be clearly cognized. But nevertheless, in Judaism, it is physical life that is celebrated and toasted with l'chaim, because it is only through the union of body and soul that this world, that our lives, can be sanctified. The embrace of physical existence is reflected throughout the opening of the Siddur. We have the blessing known as Asher Yatzar, which expresses gratitude to God for the normal functioning of our bodies. And then there are the Birkot HaShachar, the blessings of the morning, which are today traditionally recited in the synagogue, but which were originally intended to serve as constant small moments of thankfulness from the moment that one wakes up, so that every physical experience is an opportunity for expressing gratitude to God. Thus, the moment one opens one's eyes, one is instructed to bless the God who is Pokeach Ivrim, bestower of the ability to see to those that had been blind. In preparing to stand on the ground, one blesses the God who is Rokah Haaretz Al HaMayim, establishes the firmness of earth on dry land. The blessing of Malbish Arumim, thanking he who gives clothing to the naked, is said upon feeling the physical sensation of clothes on our skin. And when we begin to walk, we thank God who is Mechin Mitzadei Gaver, makes ready the walking of mankind. Every single physical sensation at the beginning of our day has a bracha, a blessing. Does this seem to be overdoing it? Might these blessings seem, to someone entirely outside the system, to embody an obsessive religious expression? Maybe, but the truth is that if we look to sources of Jewish wisdom, we learn what a gift the union of soul and body actually is, and how important it is to actually express constant gratitude for the normal physical functions that we take for granted. And I know this because of my own intimate encounter with a sacred seeker of wisdom, one who at a certain moment found himself in a dungeon of his own, one of a very different sort than that of Socrates. And unlike Socrates, this wise man clung to life, physical life, even in the midst of pain, and sanctified that life in the way that he lived. It was in 1984 that my grandfather, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, suffered a stroke, severely disabling the left side of his body. A day later, lying in bed in Evanston Hospital, he penned an essay that was titled A Glimpse at Eternity from a Hospital Dungeon, wherein he reflected on the nature of the neshama, the soul. Dear friends, he began, as I lie in bed in a chamber in a hospital dungeon, trying to recuperate from the agonizing effects of the stroke that afflicted me last Sunday evening, I am taking the liberty to give vent to my introspective analysis of my condition and of the nature of the human soul in general. My grandfather went on to explain that as a person of faith, he had always believed in the soul, but now he wished to express that he actually felt its existence, experienced the fact that his body had frozen, had ceased to function normally, but that his soul was still vibrant. He reflected that usually, quote, the body and soul are synthesized and integrated in such a beautiful and well-integrated pattern that for all practical purposes, the soul appears to be immanent in the body. Prior to the stroke, he continued, my belief in the extraneous character of the soul was grounded exclusively in emunah, meaning in faith. Now, he continued, my belief in the extraneous character of the soul and immortality of the soul is grounded in a physical perception through the biological senses, end quote. Thus did my grandfather feel that he had suddenly become ever more aware of both body and soul and of the blessing that had been the integration of body and soul throughout his life prior to the stroke. But the disability with which he was suddenly struck did not mean that he rejected his physical self. An article in the New York Times soon after the stroke described how he lived, how he commuted weekly from Chicago to New York to teach Torah, to teach Talmud. Quote, every week, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik leaves his home in Chicago and boards a plane for New York. There, though a stroke 3 years ago has left him in constant pain and barely able to walk, he slowly makes his way from an apartment to a classroom building at the Elchanan Theological Seminary, where 70 rabbinical students fill a classroom and listen attentively to the man they call Rav Aaron. The article goes on to tell us that, quote, the daily walk from his apartment on Yeshiva's campus on Amsterdam Avenue and 185th Street to an adjacent classroom building takes nearly a half hour. Do you know what it's like to tie my shoes or to put the tefillin on my hand? He asked, holding out his shaking left hand and pointing to where he binds the traditional phylacteries each morning. It's as difficult as parting the Red Sea, end quote. Thus did the article describe my grandfather's determination to continue to teach, to embrace but physical life in a way in which his soul expressed itself, teaching Torah, walking to prayer, placing the tefillin. The piece concludes with this quote from him. I've never allowed myself to become victimized and frustrated by the stroke. With God's help, I have been strengthened. Here we have a man who's experienced a terrible tragedy and who utilized this event as a means of strengthening his faith. He concluded his own essay about glimpsing eternity from a hospital dungeon with the following, and if you knew him, this is classic. He wrote, I want to point out that when I use the expression a hospital dungeon, I do not mean to criticize the service of Evanston Hospital. On the contrary, in my remotest imagination, I could not visualize better service than that given at Evanston Hospital by the doctors and nurses. And he explained, that his expression, a hospital dungeon, is, quote, merely descriptive of the agonizing condition that overtakes a handicapped body and an anguished heart, tossed by numerous and multifarious feelings of frustration, loneliness, detachment, and abandonment, end quote. So what gave my grandfather the strength to suffer so much and yet emerge from the event so optimistically, so faithfully, strengthening his relationship with God while at the same time remaining sensitive to the feelings of others, those at the hospital? The answer is given not only by our sages and our Siddur, but also by Dr. John McMahon, a neurologist at the hospital, who penned a short reflection on my grandfather's essay. And this, I have been informed, was the only time in the 50-year history of Tradition, the journal published by the Rabbinical Council of America, that a piece by a non-Jew was published. Dr. McMahon wrote about my grandfather's words, quote, "Of the deep spirituality that informs and indeed motivates the work, I can only express humble appreciation that it enables the author to derive from the sufferings of an illness still greater insight, wisdom, and understanding is obvious from the text. A non-medical reader may find the fact unremarkable. This practicing physician finds it otherwise, for the deep strength and resources to do so are rarely in evidence during bedside rounds, and, for all that physicians can now accomplish, we cannot effectively prescribe for the wellsprings of the soul when comes the skill to bring goodness from the adversity of disease," end quote. As we read the doctor's words, we realize how profoundly my grandfather, in the midst of suffering, sanctified the hospital in which he found himself, how he inspired others. Ner Hashem Nishmat Adam, we are told in Proverbs. The soul of man is the candle or lamp of God. The soul of man, not the angel, is the lamp of God. Which means, I think, that in discovering our humanity, we discover the light within us all. The light through which my grandfather, in the midst of his suffering, became a pole star, a beacon to so many. It is in the physical world, a world that is filled with striving and even at times pain, that the soul has the ability, in the body, to become a source of supreme sanctity and luminance. When I give tours of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, I take my guests to the grand painting of Socrates in the dungeon. It is truly extraordinary. But there is another painting of a man at the end of his life that speaks to me so much more, a painting that gives us a scene that is so much more Jewish in spirit. It is, of course, a painting by Rembrandt, and its meaning to me will now seem understandable, if not utterly obvious. In stark contrast to Socrates' eager abandonment of this world, in contrast to the way in which Socrates' hands extend away from Crito, this painting by Rembrandt depicts a grandfather, Jacob, extending his hands toward his grandchildren, toward the sons of Joseph, in order to bless them. His hands caress their heads, his physical self touches theirs, and in the moment their spirits commune as well. It is the work of grandfather and grandsons, a depiction of radiant spirituality made manifest through physicality, a picture of a blessing bestowed, reminding us how life sanctified through the union of body and soul is the greatest blessing of all. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to continuing our journey through Jewish prayer together. Signing off.